Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms both in the system and within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm happy today to have as my guest Kathy Kelly. Kathy Kelly is the co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, which started how many years ago, Kathy?
We began in 1996, Martin Luther King's birthday, January 15th, 1996.
Well, that's a really fitting time for an organization of nonviolence as Voices in the Wilderness. And you're basically focused on the subject, on the issue of Iraq and stopping the sanctions. And now, of course, we've just had, I don't even like to call it a war, a slaughter, an invasion of Iraq. And you were there. You spent a lot of time in Iraq. You want to tell me more about the organization first before we get into that, either way?
Well, thanks, Sue. Voices was formed by a group of people who had been in Iraq during the first Gulf War, either before or during or immediately after that war. And we recognized with no small amount of chagrin by late 1995, that in fact that war had never ended. It had turned into an economic warfare that was really far more brutal and devastating than even the worst of the bombardment in 1991. So we determined that we would try to use what we did know something about, nonviolent direct action, to challenge, to confront these economic sanctions that had been so disastrous, so brutally punitive toward innocent civilians. And once we determined we would do it, it really was fairly simple. I mean, what do you do to resist economic sanctions? You break them. So we stated to then U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno that we would go to Iraq as often as we possibly could, carrying medicines and medical relief supplies for distribution amongst ordinary Iraqis. And we immediately got a letter of very stiff warning saying that if we persisted with that idea, we would risk 12 years in prison and a $1 million fine. And then we thanked the government for the clarity of the warning and said that we would go ahead, that we wouldn't be governed by unjust laws. We started our first delegation work in March of 1996. And by the time that the war was looking almost inevitable, we had sent about 65 delegations to Iraq, all of them an open and public violation of the economic sanctions, but of equal importance, all of them coming back to the United States to talk about what they'd seen and heard in Iraq. And I think that all of these delegations and the many, many delegations that went to Iraq with Vets for Peace and Pax Christi and Fellowship of Reconciliation and Middle East Children's Alliance, and there's so many groups, it's hard to name them all, but they had accomplished a kind of an infrastructure of education in this country that was vastly needed and that I think did make a difference. You know, in 1991, I know myself that I and my companions that were dedicated peace activists who'd worked hard on Central American disarmament, we knew how to spell Kuwait and we could find Iraq on a map. And for many of us, that exhausted what we knew, and we hadn't always paid attention to what people working on issues related to Palestine were trying to explain to us about the Middle East context. So it was different this time around. There were many communities that had educated themselves about what the U.S. role in manipulating the 661 Committee in the United Nations had been before a military bombardment. And that education convinced, I think, all of us that there had been an ongoing warfare, a terrible and a very sinister kind of warfare that directly targeted the most vulnerable people in Iraq, and that had so tragically been waged using the United Nations. The United Nations, founded to eliminate the scourge of warfare, had been used to persecute and punish unto death children. And that's what had happened through the sanctions. So in May of 2002, our group proposed an Iraq peace team. We said that we would work hard to prevent a war, that we wanted to be voices for ordinary Iraqis, but that we would remain alongside Iraqi people before and during a war, should a war occur. And if we were there during a war, again, try to be their voice, because we anticipated that the mainstream media might not give so much of a voice to ordinary Iraqis and bring some measure of comfort to them if we could. So that's why I was there throughout the build-up to the Shock and Awe campaign, and then during the bombing and invasion and in the initial days of occupation.
Well, I have been hearing your voice over KPFA here in the Bay Area for, it seems like, a really long time, and that's how I know about you. And I know that most people haven't really, most Americans haven't really had a sense of how much how much the sanctions, and it seems like there was bombing every week or two for the last, 12 years since the first Gulf War. Again, the word war is just not the right word for these things. But we're using it, but it's just so unfair and unjust. It doesn't seem like the right word. So you have, back to that other question, you must have spent yourself a lot of time in Iraq, at least off and on over all these years, and have many friends there.
I've been really lucky. I haven't mastered Arabic by a long shot. I can deal with the four-year-olds pretty well and sort of figure out if someone's talking about me in the same room. But people there have been enormously hospitable and friendly to us over the years, in spite of the fact that we came from a country that was causing them really grievous harm. As you can imagine, during the warfare, we became very, very close to the people with whom we lived. We were in a family-run hotel called the Al-Fanar, and we were immediately across from the riverfront, and then in the river, in the middle of the river, there was a very extensive palace that was given by Saddam Hussein to his son, Uday. So that was hit numerous times during the war, and then we weren't very far from a number of government ministry buildings, which were also hit with some regularity. And we were immediately adjacent to the Palestine Hotel that housed 750 Western and international journalists. And I suppose in some ways we thought, well, you know, if you're going to be next door to a hotel with all kinds of Westerners, maybe there's more protection. But in fact, that hotel took a direct hit. Anyway, we grew very, very close to the people with whom we stayed.
Did I hear that you weren't allowed to work with the other journalists or something? Did I hear something about that?
Well, Sue, that refers to a time after the occupation had begun. We could just by, you know, inhaling, realize that there hadn't been any garbage pickup immediately outside of our hotel or anywhere else in the city. We were aware of an outbreak of cholera in a place called Hilla. We were very aware that the non-governmental organizations from several other countries who had been in Iraq, there really weren't very many in the center and the south, actually about five, but they were represented in this hotel where we'd stayed, and they had crucial information that we felt that the occupying troops really needed to know, like where are the hospitals and clinics and the storehouses that had medicines. And we ourselves had some questions about what kind of plan this new occupying force had, given the outbreaks of chaos and the disintegration that was going on all around us. So two of our people wanted to go over and talk to the Coalition Military Operations Center and find out something from them and communicate some information we thought would be helpful. And it was kind of a disturbing realization we had when Ramzi Qaisi and Kathy Breen said to them that there was an outbreak of cholera in Hilla, and the person in charge said, now is Hilla a street or a neighborhood in Baghdad? And they said, no, Hilla is a major city in the center of Iraq. And when they indicated that they really didn't have any interest in working with the non-governmental organizations unless those organizations could subordinate themselves to the military command. And we said, well, that, you know, these organizations can't do that. They have to maintain neutrality. But could you at least talk to them? Could we come back and talk to you later? Could we talk to somebody perhaps who's higher up? And the word was, no, please go. There's nothing you can do. We really shouldn't be talking to people like you. So our group quickly put out a press release feeling that if the kind of nerve center for this occupation couldn't talk to us, then maybe the media could alert them to some of the problems that we thought were so needing of attention. And after that press release went out the very same night, we found that our stationery was laid out on the ground, and in fact they had silver bullets surrounding the letterhead, and there was a word that we were banned from entering the building where the military command had their center and where also 750 journalists were housed. And now, quite honestly, I think that our people go in and out of that building anyway, but it's a sign. I would want to say, though, that most of the Marines that we spoke with when they first arrived shouldn't be characterized as people who were hostile toward us. If anything, that we were amazed at how forthcoming they were. They'd ask us questions like, you know, could you tell us your side of the story? Or could I pray with you? Or could we sit with you for a while? And the commanding officer actually said, don't blame these young men for what happened. In the heat of battle, I made some hasty decisions, and a lot of civilians were killed, and it's I who will have sleepless nights. But it wasn't just him, because quite a lot of them would come over in the middle of the night to watch the television news, the BBC News, or sit and talk, and they told us many things about how miserable they felt about the war and about what they'd done. We heard a lot of remorse and regret. One young man said, you know, I can't wait to get out of the military as soon as I get back, and I'm glad that I was responsible only to bring up prisoners in the rear, and I didn't use my gun, but I saw others who killed civilians outright when they could have shot at the tires of an advancing car, and that was wrong. Another said that at one point they couldn't tell because there were fatigues on the ground whether they were dealing with civilians or military people, so they shot everybody. And then he pointed to his head and he said, I hope that never registers here. Another one said that he did everything he could to jam his gun and not to shoot it. And my hope is that as some of these vets return, particularly the Marines that were part of the group that were engaged in combat on the way from Basra up to Baghdad, that they'll be listened to fully. And sure, I'm sure some will feel that they are, you know, proud of an achievement that they might never, ever again accomplish anything greater in their lifetime. But I'm quite sure that others will want to help us with counter-recruitment. Mm-hmm. And as we try to uproot the roots of war in our own lives, in our own circles, in our own society, along with questioning our own lifestyles, which sometimes almost seem to require a war to protect our horrible levels of waste and consumption, along with confronting the companies that make the munitions and considering ways that we can withdraw financial support for military, I think we also need to think about the education systems and the vulnerability that our young people have to recruitment to join the military, and see if we can't get some of these returning vets to help us with counter-recruitment.
Well, absolutely. That sounds like a good idea. And, of course, there's so much depleted uranium in Iraq, which affects, I would imagine, everybody, including you. Are people aware of that? And I don't know if our audience is aware of it, but depleted uranium is very not good for your health. And In just about all the bullets and weapons, I understand, that have been dropping on Iraq from the United States for the last 13 years now, and it's quite horrendous. Are you concerned about that, or do you see a lot of effects of that depleted uranium?
There's been a fivefold rise in childhood cancers in Iraq, and the cure rate for children with cancer is 0%. And certainly over many, many visits to hospital bedsides and to a particular cancer ward, I've sat with mothers while their children move into the last days of their lives. And it's a terrific bereavement. You know, arms will ache for loved ones that will never again return. And many, many congenital deformities that doctors reported that they had never seen such problems prior to the war. And of course, the Gulf War syndrome that afflicted veterans from the first Gulf War, I think, is yet to be fully understood, but we owe it, we really owe it to every one of those soldiers. They didn't choose to place themselves into the line of fire where they could be poisoned by radioactive material that has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. And there's so much research that still needs to be done. Helen Caldicott, of Physicians for Social Responsibility, will be helping to convene a day of education about depleted uranium and its effects. They said that 300 tons of depleted uranium fell on Iraq during the first Gulf War, and some conjecture suggests that 900 tons of it might have been dropped this time. So it seems that the after effects could be simply horrendous. And I know that many people are saying, well, let's get a count of the casualties, and we should all care about every single life that was lost, and not lose sight of how many people in the military died, how many civilians died, how many U.S. soldiers died. But I don't really think you can declare a finish line when making those kinds of counts, because we have no idea how many are going to lose their lives because of the consequences of depleted uranium. And I guess it's harsh, but we must remember that 47,000 children died after the first Gulf War, long after the bombing had ended, but they died in those first months after the bombing ended from waterborne diseases and malnutrition.
And that's not even to mention, to include the radiation. It's just unbelievable to me when I hear about it. The devastation, and I'd like you to say more about that in a minute. I'd like to remind people that my guest is Kathy Kelly, who is a co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness and has been working on getting the word out and stopping the sanctions and stopping the war, and been a witness nonviolent activist both in the United States and been over in Iraq herself. So, you know, back to the thing about the American military, and you were saying some people were not happy about what they were doing, or probably a lot of people didn't even know what they were doing, I would imagine. And I heard over here that the United States, basically the military, was ordered, I mean, that they facilitated the quote-unquote looting. Not only did they not stop it, but they tore down doors and walls and stuff so people could get in. Was that your experience? Did you witness that?
I have a very close friend, an Iraqi man, who said that he witnessed a United States tank approach a storage unit that had 1 to 2 years' worth of rice and grain stored inside while there were people milling about, and that the officer commanding the tank spoke Arabic with a Kuwaiti accent, that he told the tank to fire at the gate and blast it open, and then said to the people milling around, take what you want, and if you want to burn the rest, go ahead. And that's what happened. The place was completely looted, and then there was burning, and so it's been destroyed.
Why would people want to burn food when they know they were going to need it, that people would need it? That doesn't make sense to me. I mean, I believe you. But
The only thing I can tell you in addition is that he said that Iraqi people asked the people setting the fires exactly that question, and that the people setting the fires did not respond with an Iraqi accent. So, you know, it's very difficult to document and verify, but that's anecdotal, but I would never, ever have any reason to doubt that this person would tell us what he had seen and heard truthfully. I thought a lot about this issue of looting, and, you know, you think about mindless and wanton destruction, and you have to ask why. But, you know, I don't want to sound too pious, but I think it's good for me to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, I start mindless and wanton destruction every morning as soon as I get out of bed, when you consider what our very comfortable society does every day, using up the world's resources and producing so much waste. In terms of Mother Earth, in terms of the planet, our lifestyle is completely wanton. The planet can't sustain us, and it's mindless because we're not very mindful of it. We just go ahead anyway. The other thing I want to say is that some of the major corporations that might be just so respectable, that would never be looked upon as riffraff, in their way might, who knows, might be involved in looting and thievery in Iraq if, in fact, it works out that Iraq's oil wealth starts to go into the pockets of major corporations and doesn't go to benefit Iraqi people who have so long deserved to have control over their resources in ways that are beneficial for their population. The other thing that I'd like to say about looting is that it seems to me that there was a social volcano that erupted within Iraq, and it was a volcano of antagonism and anger, I think fueled because many people in their poverty and in the frustration that they experienced could only see a way to lay the blame close at hand. They probably, many of the ones who looted did blame those who seemed to live more affluent and comfortable lives during that long stretch when they were living under grinding poverty and couldn't feed their children and suffered many indignities. And they couldn't always see that, in fact, people very far away had a major hand in their suffering. And by that, I mean the manipulation of the 661 Committee in the United Nations, which directly caused humanitarian crises and suffering, and I think they, you know, caused murder of innocent children.
But I'm not familiar with those numbers of this committee, the 661 Committee, although I know something about the story for sure. I'm not sure what you're referring to.
Yeah, thanks. I should clarify. Resolution 661 was the resolution which required the imposition of the economic sanctions, but then the 661 Committee would examine every single request that the government of Iraq made to get commodities into the country. The government of Iraq never could get cash into the country. They'd sell their oil, but they never got revenues in the form of cash. All the money went to a bank account in New York City, the signatories to which were only United Nations officials. So it was kind of like a Mother May I game. The government of Iraq would say, okay, may we have a contract for this number of commodities? And usually it would take a year for a contract to be fulfilled. And
was this the food for oil?
Under the oil for food deal.
Oil for food, sorry.
Yeah. And Joy Gordon of Fairfield, Connecticut, Fairfield University, wrote a book called Cool War, which will be issued by Harvard Press. But she has a very, very fine article about that in the November 2002 issue of Harper's Magazine. But again, I want to stress, you and I can read this and study it and get to be more familiar with these issues. But many people inside Iraq, I mean, they couldn't be reading these United Nations documents. And so they blame the ones close at hand. Not to say that the government of Iraq wasn't very blameworthy. The highest levels of the regime did deserve plenty of blame. But I think when you think of a volcano of social unrest erupting, it's probably a good idea for me to realize that in Chicago, in my city, there are neighborhoods which could erupt, and the Magnificent Mile, which is, you know, a very revered part of Chicago, could suffer quite a lot of damage were that to happen.
Well, no, I probably didn't express myself well, but I don't... It's easy to understand why people would want to loot to get things that other people had and they haven't had. That's not the part I don't understand. And the main point is that the United States, the military, was facilitating this. And of course, the way things get translated and presented in the American media is always, in the corporate media, is always most often so distorted anyway, and it looks one way when it's really another on the when you're on the spot where it's happening. So that's what I was particularly interested about that, because I know somebody said to me, well, I was really sympathetic with the Iraqis, but now that I see that they're pulling, you know, tearing everything apart, they really are like, you know, don't know how to, you know, how to behave, kind of thing. and I heard this with the information that the U.S. military was facilitating it. So it just seemed like another example of really distorted information to make a certain impression, to get support for the U.S. military, to get support in this country for that.
Well, I think also two simple observations. One is that across Iraq there are many soldiers who are home now from the war that we don't want to call a war because we think it was a slaughter. They're at their homes, they have their gun, and they don't have a job. And there are many thousands of people that have been in prison. And Saddam Hussein made the decision, release them all. And they're in their homes, and they have a gun, and they don't have a job. So, yeah, it doesn't take too long to figure out that that's not such a good formula for security. We do have a lot of reason, I think, to wonder, is there any chance, and this is really cynical, I know, but is there any chance that the United States designers of this war saw some advantage in allowing enough chaos to pervade that Iraqi people themselves would say, please govern us? And that, just as you said, the Iraqi people would look ungovernable and appear in the eyes of people around the world as people who don't deserve our compassion. But I am hopeful that people in the United States won't succumb to that. I am hoping that there will be heartstrings that can be plucked, mm-hmm. and that people who heard the Bush administration say it was going to war because of weapons of mass destruction, and then see no weapons of mass destruction, that it was going to war because Iraq is connected to Al-Qaeda, and then see there are still no signs that would hold up in a court of law of connection to Al-Qaeda. We'll ask, now, why did we go to that war? And okay, if now the United States wants to say, well, democracy and freedom and a better life were made available to Iraqis, well, let's wait and see. And if such is not occurring, if it's not forthcoming, then it's my hope that if Iraqi people engage in a creative resistance, and I hope and pray it will be an unarmed resistance, that they will be able to go right over the heads of the military, right over the heads of the warmongers and the politicians, and reach the hearts of American people and say, we want our chance.
Mm-hmm. I was just gonna break. Well, we only have like a minute left here, and I know that you'd like to give the contact, Kathy Kelly, for Voices in the Wilderness, and also anything that people can be doing. And I wanted to ask you also, real quick, did anybody from your group get imprisoned, or did the government come down on you for taking in the medications and things that you did to Iraq so many times?
Well, thank you. www.electronicirock.net. Spell it right out, electronicirock.net for the website we update most frequently. We also have another www.vitw.org. Fines have been imposed on our organization, $10,000, another $10,000 fine for me and for three of our members in the Seattle area. None of us have paid those fines, but journalists have called the Treasury Department, and the Treasury Department says we have paid up. It may be that they don't want to get into any kind of an encounter with us, because now the United States government might be ready to break sanctions. It's a curious situation, isn't it?
Yes, it is. That's a very good point. It is a very curious situation in terms of the sanctions right now, because they want to make their money. That's kind of, in my opinion, probably the whole point.
Well, let's hope that we'll never see such sanctions imposed on any other country, on any group of people ever again. Let's hold Mr. Bush to his statement that no one in conscience could impose such sanctions that interfere with the aspirations of people. And let's hope that we can, all of us, continue a spotlight on Iraq. If we have a hope of preventing a next war, we have to tell the truth about this war. And Voices in the Wilderness and Iraq Peace Team members are more than ready. We're avid. We're eager to help communicate the truth of what we've seen and heard, and to connect with the many, many groups that really helped create one of the finest anti-war efforts that's been launched in modern history. We must keep it going.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much, Kathy Kelly. And I didn't tell people that you were actually nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, and I would say that you certainly deserve it. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Sue.
My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening. To order a copy of the program you just heard, write down the following information. The email is sue@suesupriano.com. That's Sue, S-U-E, at Sue Supriano, SUESUPRIANO.com. Or the telephone is 510-883-1979. That's 510-883-1979.